This is Patricia Warming, February 24th, 1992, Toward Rediscovery of the Soul.
Following the early meetings, the Lord's soul or soul image Thank you. The European Oh. If thou dost communicate to the being of the soul of the unconscious, you are the first calling For you, the unconscious was a repository, a holding, a place, if you will, with content. Whatever was not conscious was something, not nothing. Many said of souls, it cannot be nothing but. As you know things repository, you saw this content as being both personal and collective. You describe the personal unconscious as everything of which I know, but of which I'm not emotional. Everything of which was once conscious, but have not, or I've not forgotten. Everything perceived by my senses, but not noted by my conscious mind. Everything which involuntarily without paying attention to it, I feel, think, remember, want, and do. Over and above these contents, we also find the unconscious qualities that are not individually qualities, but are inherent. Instinct enables us to carry out actions from necessity without conscious motivation. In its deeper strand, we also find the archetype. The instinct and the archetype together form what we call the collective unconscious. We call it collective because it's made of contents which are universal and of regular occurrence. It forms us, as it were, an omnipresent, unseen, and ever-sort identical quality and substrate of its presence of faith. It was for the only eternally living, creative, brilliant of your consciousness. Not only did the unconscious contain both its instincts and its whole spiritual nature of man and woman, but also the roots of all creativity. This background and substrate of the psychological world is forever bringing forth forms, forth spontaneous forms in that analogous motion. Now, that is so other than what we've been talking about in terms of the scientific experience. And when we talk about the spontaneous forms that arise spontaneously, we're talking about imagery. The human self as imagery with a language of psyche, the very mirror of the soul. Jung considers images to be the basic image of psychic life, self-originated, invented, spontaneous, complete, organized in archetypal families. They are the fully-explored aspects and knowledge of soul. Psychic existence is the only category of existence of which we have immediate knowledge. It's nothing to be known unless it appears as psychic image. So as men and women, we are primarily image makers. And our psychic substance consists of images. And they can be the stuff of which dreams are made. Many of you may know the work of Matthew Fox, creation of theology. Matthew Fox says every picture is a birthday of images. To give a rather tangible example of a five-year-old boy, the popular boy told me there are four kinds of beans. Green beans, purple beans, yellow beans, and green beans. These beans are special. Not that green beans are special, he said. He replied, people eat green beans, yellow beans, and purple beans. And I eat green beans. Not all of them to eat them. Beans come hard to die, and they have to go all along. God's belly is the traitor. Not ideal. It is always both. The strength of soul is neither physical and material on the one hand, nor spiritual and abstract on the other, but mind and soul. If and if consciousness rests on self-sustaining and imagining substance, an inner faith, a deeper scripture, or ongoing presence, that is strictly there, even when our subjectivity, ego, and consciousness both exist. It is the contagious energy of the individual that constitutes what we're doing, drawn upon the basic condition called the subtle body or heart soul. The subtle body we know how to use place in the soul to bring it all together in the third. This holds the physical and other senses to act as a catalyst, using energy from both sides. Overvalued mental concept and pushing that as the only expression.
obviously down to Pentagon. We can certainly cross over the border, but typically we've looked at and has not been afraid to live in the law into the world, and he's been every culture to work on. And most of these people have come as well as political leaders.
Yeah. Now, the next thing I'd like to talk about is what Hillman talks about in the sense of soul referring to the deepening of events into experience. Jung says, one cannot just think up a system or truth which would give the patient what he needs to live, namely faith, hope, love, and understanding. I'm quoting Jung. These are gifts of grace, which are neither to be taught nor learned, since they come through experience. Experiences cannot be made. They happen. There are ways in which we can draw closer to living experience. Yet, Jung warns us to beware of calling these ways methods. The very word has a deadening effect. The way to experience is a venture which requires us to commit ourselves with our whole being. Experience itself is the essence of soul-making. This parallels Matthew Fox's, again, reflections on mysticism when he says, the first meaning of mysticism is experience itself. He quotes Kabir, the great 15th century creation mystic of India. I say only what I have seen with my own eyes, and you keep quoting the scriptures. He goes on, experience, O seeker, is the essence of all things. Soul for Hillman also refers to the deepening of, as I said, to the deepening of events into experiences. It has to do with that unknown factor which turns events into experiences, that unknown factor. As it says in the ancient Chinese book of wisdom, the I Ching, the event is not important, but the response to the event is everything. A lot of things that we consider interference or irritants along the way are actually part of the path itself. We can look at these obstacles as opportunities for growth. We can give attention to details we might otherwise overlook. We put heart and soul into our lives by the way we touch things, through the deepness and authenticity of our attention. With attention and some sense of love and a deep focus, we ensoul the things we work on, ensoul the people we touch and are touched by. Soul is from a place that's authentic. It cannot be faked. I wanted to just describe an experience, just briefly, a writing that a client of mine, this was many, many years ago, wrote. This was a woman, actually, whom I saw while I was in Zurich. And she actually was, she was not poetic in the way she presented things. She presented things very matter-of-factly. She had a lot of suffering in her life. And But one day she simply brought me this, and without, it's not important that you know her, it's just to listen to what she had to say. I was very surprised when I read it. The depth and the poetic way in which she wrote it was very uncharacteristic of her, and yet something had moved her very deeply, and I want simply to share how an event became for her an experience. She wrote, after a period of the deepest personal distress I have ever known, I had begun making some progress toward recovery. My work had taken a new and interesting turn. I sought a few hours of planned-in sightseeing in the mountains, a rather mechanical preparation, deciphering the train schedule, finding the little railway station in the valley, and buying the tickets, occupied my thoughts. Once on the train, I settled down among the other anonymous passengers and watched us climb the steep ascent. Being only an occasional traveler, I was conscious of every stop and of making the right transfers a couple of times along the way. The sky was half cloudy, gray, and closing in. The distant haze caused me to focus on the nearer objects. Myriad wild flowers growing alongside the tracks were a delight. The trees seemed so firmly planted to earth and to be reaching up together to see which would touch the heavens first. The rocks, who had put them there and how long ago? They seemed ageless, but their mossy coverings involved them in this year's growing and dying. On top of the mountain, one saw only a partial panorama. A faint hint of the closest snow range could be discerned. But nothing has ever impressed me as being more perfectly ordered or more vast. Suddenly, without warning, I felt a depth and a fullness within that set me in perfect harmony with what I visually beheld. Undescribable wonder gripped me. There was no way to capture the feeling. I remained a silent part of the lonely gray landscape, and no one could have guessed the ecstasy that had come to me. And then she wrote, a year and a half later, I questioned what happened to me alone on the mountain that day. I believe that this was an experience of reality. I believe that God was there on his initiative. He said nothing. He demanded nothing of me. He showed me that he could fill the unknown vastness of my life, which had been created by grief, hurt, loneliness, and even loss of faith. I knew that in his love, I was reclaimable. So soul-making has to do with the act of attention and devotion on the part of the ego and a willingness to see what wants to appear. Now, the next thing I want to talk about just briefly, and again, it's a whole subject of itself, and so I only will make note of it, but I want to talk about the importance of the human connection for soul-making. In Jung's essay on the transference, he stresses the importance of the human connection for soul-making, stating that there can be no synthesis of personality without the conscious acknowledgement and acceptance of our fellowship with those around us. The conscious achievement of unity clings to human relationships as an indispensable condition. I like the words of a Native American teacher. We need to bring our dreams and visions down to earth and to put them into our lives. In my country, we cannot stagger around in our visions. The rattlesnake teaches us that. We need to be awake and put attention to where we place our feet. We find soul within the simplicity of our mundane tasks and our relationships with ordinary people. Also, it is through our souls that we are immanent with one another. The I-thou relationship is a necessity. It is soul that can convert the it into a thou. And that is why Jung says that the cure of souls can only be carried on in the stillness of a colloquy. Soul must work on soul, and many doors be unlocked that bar the way to the innermost sanctuary. I think that's so important. I start wondering today with the possibilities we have with computers, how long it will be before we just turn it on and plug in our symbol and the amplification comes out and we know what X means and we do our work. But I think it's so important that we're engaged in a soul process, and the intimate connection with another human being in our soul work is so important. And that we can't, it's difficult to do that by ourselves. For soul to be present, there needs to be real meeting. Physical proximity or even mutual exchange of ideas does not necessarily constitute meeting. Duration has nothing to do with it, nor even do common interests. Frequently, husbands and wives can have the closest physical proximity for years and yet have no real meeting, each locked away in an isolation of his or her own. For there to be a meeting, it seems as though a third, a something else, is always present. As Jungians, we would say it would be the presence of the self. You may call it love. If this other is present, there can be a meeting. Our greatest task is not to learn to love, but to learn how to create conditions in which love can light upon us and remain with us. Now, one of the ways, perhaps, to create these conditions is to become more aware of how others in our lives carry our projections. I mentioned at the beginning Jung's use of the word soul as synonymous with anima as an inner figure, namely the inner feminine within a man's psyche, and how anima can represent a man's soul. The term anima has been used to characterize the personification of the soul, and as I said, the anima figures in a man's dreams are thus soul images that reveal the soul's character. In this way, we talk about the soul personality as a contrasexual opposite. To avoid getting into more thorny problems, like, for instance, does that make a woman's soul masculine? At which point Jung does say that, and I wouldn't like that at all. I prefer to think of soul as an interior personality which carries all aspects that have been neglected by our exterior persona. Our partners, significant others, often carry our soul projections, as do our children, our jobs, our money, and so forth. Because of its elusiveness, we often have to experience and recognize soul through projection. Projecting the soul enables us to deal with it. So the aim of analysis is not necessarily to withdraw all our projections, but to become aware of them, to live intensely while seeing that they are projections. We do take transference and countertransference in analysis very seriously. The patient reveals himself by what he projects on the analyst and vice versa. And in these mutual projections, soul appears. Now, I think I do, on the bibliography I gave you. My favorite work on this subject is Robert Johnson's little book, We. Have you read that? I would highly recommend this for further reference on this subject. It's a beautiful little book on the soul and the projection of the soul. It includes a commentary on the myth of Tristan and Isolde. And it also has in the back of it the Sioux Indian myth of the white bison spirit woman. But for the subject of soul and relationship, I highly recommend Robert's book. The next thing I want to mention about soul is that it is vulnerable and suffers. When a person comes into analysis, the first thing he or she wants is to draw the analyst into her world of experience. And this usually means making the analyst aware of suffering. In Psychotherapy and a Philosophy of Life, Jung wrote, "The principal aim of psychotherapy is not to transport the patient to an impossible state of happiness, but to help him acquire steadfast enough and philosophic patience in the face of suffering. Life demands for its completion and fulfillment a balance between joy and sorrow. Behind a neurosis is often concealed all the natural and necessary suffering the patient has been unwilling to bear." So that we could say that a psychoneurosis can be understood ultimately as the suffering of the soul, which has not discovered its meaning. Jung sees the cause of the suffering to be psychic sterility or spiritual stagnation. And he says the doctor is now confronted with the necessity of conveying to his patient the healing fiction, the meaning that quickens. For it is this that the sick person longs for, over and above everything that reason and science can give him. He is looking for something that will take possession of him and give meaning and form to the confusion of his neurotic soul. So that as analysts and therapists, we face problems. And these problems are not, as humans, we face problems. And the problems that we have are not merely classifiable behavioral acts, medical categories of disease. They are, above all, experiences and sufferings, problems with an inside. Experience and suffering are terms long associated with soul. So that the study of lives and the care of soul means, above all, a prolonged encounter with what is broken and hurts, and that is with psychopathology. Psyche means soul, pathos means suffering, logos means thought or meaning. Therefore, psychopathology is finding the meaning of the suffering soul. Now, the insights of depth psychology come from souls in extremis. And as you probably know, Jung did his work as a doctoral student or medical student in the Burkholzli, the medical or mental institution in Zurich. And he observed the sick, the suffering, the abnormal and fantastic conditions of soul. Our souls, whether in private, with one another or even in public exhibit psychopathology. Each soul at some time or another demonstrates illusions, depressions, addictions, compulsions, anxieties, or perversions. And so psychopathology has an intimate connection with our individuality. We each have an odd, deviant, second or maybe third personality that provides another perspective to our regular life. And the deeper we know ourselves and the other persons of our complexes, the more we recognize how well we too fit into the textbook sketches of abnormal psychology. That these case histories are also our own biographies. I remember once before I went to Zurich, I took I did a postmaster's degree at Loyola College in Baltimore, and I was able to take some classes at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and I took a course in psychopathology, and the woman instructor got up at the beginning of the class and gave us a little lecture on how, as we learned every kind of pathology, we would have the existential experience of saying, "That's me, I've got that." And she was warning us to begin with, to kind of expect that kind of experience, that as we went into each one of these, we would be gripped, so to speak, and think, "My God, I've got that myself." Before we make any attempt to treat or even understand pathologized phenomenon, we need to meet them as an act of faith, regarding them as authentic, real, and valuable as they are. They are ways of the psyche and ways of finding soul. Pathologizing forces the soul to a consciousness of itself as different from ego and its life. Know thyself means also know thy peculiar images. Our attempt to envision pathologizing psychologically is to find a place for it, a way of accepting it in general and as a whole. We want to know what it might be saying about the soul and what the soul might be saying about it. I think one thing I like about Jungian psychology is that if you put it on a scale of from one end to the other, on the one hand you have psychopathology and on the other hand you have a quest for spirit. And that people enter into an analytic process on either end of the scale. And typically what often happens is that people come expressing this great spiritual search that they're on, find deep ghosts in their closet and pathologies and so forth. And on the other hand, people that come with a deep pathology of some kind recognize in the process their deep spiritual longing, and so that we can enter the process on either end of the spectrum. And that all parts of the spectrum are equally important, that we just can't have one and not have it balanced somehow with the others. Now, our dreams frequently, this is the most interesting place to experience this, our dreams frequently speak with psychopathological imagery. Somehow I want to collect just dreams with pathological imagery. Sick figures in dreams have an exceptionally moving power. If you've had such a dream, you know that you are haunted during the day. You're sort of psychologically on edge, so to speak. And that you feel vulnerable, and perhaps you even feel in danger. These images, however, are often the focal point of action in the movement in soul. I want to share just a little brief dream of a client. This could be anybody's dream, but it's a very brief dream. Let me share it, and you can hear the image in here. I am in my dentist's office. I'm in my dentist's office waiting room. A baby is having a tooth fixed. I look into the examining room and see the baby strapped into a chair. She looks uncomfortable. She is a very small baby, but Dr. Bunch seems embarrassed. He whispers to me, "This is an adult, a small, deformed adult." Now I can see that too. That's the dream. So that we all somehow have in ourselves a small, deformed adult that perhaps comes in many, many forms, and you have your own unique image that pops up and you think, "I'm sick." Anyway, Hillman says that analysis offers a vessel in which our unconscious pathologizing can be poured and cooked long enough for significance to emerge to make soul. This means staying in the mess, while at the same time regarding what is going on from a mythical perspective. It is therefore of first importance to find out who, which archetypal person is involved in the psychopathology. To which person of the psyche and within which myth does the affliction belong? Which figures and which complexes are laying claim? Through a pathologized experience, I recognize that I am bound to archetypal persons who want something from me and to whom I owe remembrance. Psychology is ultimately mythology, the study of the stories of the soul. Here I renew my awareness of what is universal, of the great motifs in life that transcend our personal lives, yet are common to all. The role of myth is to render in contemporary terms the mysteries of our own inner life and the relationship of these mysteries to cosmic life. So that soul making is also myth making. And all you need to do is pick up Clarissa Estes's book on women who run with the wolves and find the many, many stories in there and the many, many places where you suddenly, men and women, find a place where they resonate with a particular story and a particular image and feel and have the, I think, really important experience of realizing that that story belongs to you, but that also belongs to others. Because I think part of our loneliness oftentimes thinking that we're the only person in humanity that has this particular problem. And it's so important to connect that that our problems are human problems and we all have them. And humankinds from time immemorial have had the same problems. Now, another thing that Hillman emphasized with soul-making is that it recognizes multiplicity. Hillman says, by letting myself be defined by the little people of dreams, I help free the soul from its identity with the ego in the waking state, thus preparing myself in some way for death. The ego is not the whole psyche, only one member of a commune. When we recognize the psyche as being comprised of multiple figures, we prevent the ego from identifying with each and every figure in a dream or fantasy. Through multiplicity, we become internally more separated, aware of distinct parts. Even if unity of personality is the aim, only separate things can unite. Maybe I will draw a little. I don't have anything particular in mind here. I'm just wanting to give you an example with dreams. And I love, actually, as just a little exercise with your dreams, if you would take your dream and simply write, draw a circle, put yourself as the ego in the dream, and write down everybody that's in your dream. Because we tend to identify with the ego. We wake up, we tell the dream from the perspective of the ego. We're on the side of the ego. And yet, this person's doing something, these people are doing something, there's a dog in the dream, she's doing something, whatever. And partly the importance of this is to recognize the multiple parts we have. You think I'm one person sitting up here, little alone. But of all the parts that are part of me and are part of you. And somehow I think it's so important, and I like the idea that how do we know what the whole is until we first know what the parts are. So it's just a simple little exercise with your dream sometimes. Just draw that circle, put your ego in there, and then put down all of those parts that are in your dream. Now, essential to this internal separation is naming the personalities. Through naming, they become they. And this has an advantage over naming with concepts. For instance, I clearly remember one male client that frequently came in and said to me, I had another dream of the feminine. What does that mean? Who is she? What does she look like? What is she doing? What's her name? And as you then begin to move from a category or a name, and we use those, certainly we Jungians we have them, shadow, anima, animus, so forth. We call them our animus. But if you move to naming them and describing them, then the image comes alive. And they become they, and their personified images that move us and have an effect on us. And also, the whole idea is the of using these is also quite a far step from giving our diseases a title. One of the things Hillman wrote, he said, as soon as the move is made, a professional naming, a distinct entity is created with literal reality. On the one thing, I am protected from this thing by separation from it. It has a name. On the other hand, I have something. I am something. I am an alcoholic, an incest survivor, an obsessive compulsive, a depressive, whatever. So I have something, and now I know what it is, and it has a name. And along with that, the therapist then becomes the very God who, by naming the condition, is the one that can take it away. I remember having a client in the clinic in Zurich once that actually made a hobby of collecting psychiatric diagnoses, and it seemed particularly satisfying to come up with varying ones. So she had her collection of them. But in contrast, images present themselves as living psychic subjects, of which I am then obliged to be in relation. And personifying happens with each of us every night in dreams. So that if we look at dreams in this way, we see the psyche's basic structure as an inscape of personified images. They tell the soul's tale in persons, and the fragmented parts are held together by the scenes and woven into stories. And these stories and these scenes include landscapes and animals and so forth. And they show the psyche as it is. Nothing is literal, all is metaphor. And we see that we are ultimately a composition of images. Our person, the personification of their life in the soul. And the dream is the mirror where they show themselves. And as I said, the idea of multiplicity frees the soul from identifying with the ego in the waking state. It thus helps prepare one for death. For it's in the face of death that we ponder and go deep and sense soul. As we reflect upon death, we build our fantasies or systems for housing it. Religion begins, as many have said, as a reflection upon death. Seen from a correct psychological perspective, Jung looks at death not as an end, but a goal. In contrast, he contrasts Freud's view of causality with what he calls finality. And by finality, he means the imminent psychological striving for a goal. Instead of striving for a goal, one could say a sense of purpose. If one considers a dream, a symptom, experience, or a problem from the standpoint of finality, then we ask, what is the purpose of this dream or symptom? What effect is it meant to have? What is it trying to say? Where is my fate or individuation process going? If we stare these questions in the face, we know, of course, that our individuation process is going to death. The one unknowable goal is the absolutely sure event of the human condition. So to live fully into the consequences of the finalistic view means that we ask, what is the purpose of this event for my soul, for my death? In every analysis, we come upon death in one form or another. Friends die, loved ones die, jobs are lost, death of attitudes, the death of love, any number of experiences of loss or separation which are described as death. The dreamer dies in his dreams. There are deaths of other inner figures. Maybe you've had that experience. The first time I had that experience in early in my analysis in Zurich, I dreamt I died. I didn't know very much at that time. I was up in the middle of the night going through the books in a panic, thinking that it was a prophetic dream and that something was going to happen. And usually it is the case that one, when one dreams that they're going to die, it never means literal death. The actual images of impending death come in much more obtuse and strange images. But when one actually dreams that one's going to die, it does not mean a physical death. It does mean some kind of death to the ego, some ingrained attitude, behavior, some way of being that no longer suits, that needs to be changed and transformed so that one can be transformed. And the ego can go through a process of change. Now, one of the interesting things that Marie-Louise von Franz discovered, and I think it's absolutely interesting, is that the dreams of dying people show continuity. The dreams of people living dream of dying. People dying dream of continuity. It's as if psychic life goes on. So from where I'm coming, any hope that I have for immortality comes from that awareness that somehow the psyche doesn't seem to be pay any attention to the dying body, but that it just dreams as if life goes on. Now, there is an idea in alchemy where it is said that making the philosopher's stone is at the same time making one's own incorruptible body. You may come from a Christian tradition that says we shall be put together at the last judgment in a new form and enter eternal life. But the alchemists think it's an inner experience, and therefore the immortal or glorified body should be produced through meditation or by an alchemical process. Out of the mortal, an immortal nucleus is built. This idea survives in the mystery cults. The eternal personality is established in this life and is not projected into a post-mortal sphere. So in this way, we build towards death from day to day. We each build our own ship of death within ourselves. Hillman quotes a poem from D.H. Lawrence entitled Ship of Death. O build your ship of death, O build it in time and build it lovingly and put it between the hands of your soul. By going consciously toward death, we build a better vessel. Ideally, as we age, this building becomes more incorruptible so that the passage to it from the failing flesh may be without fear. This death we build within us is that permanent structure, the subtle body, in which soul is housed. I'll warn you while she's doing that. I have a very nice dream of the soul, and I'm going to omit it. I'll save it for some time. Is it back on?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Some additional case material. I wanted to sort of abbreviate the few other points that I want to make, and some of the amplifying material I'll have to let go. My daughter was sick, and I was going to try to time this so I could cut it right, but I didn't have any block of time that I wasn't taking her to the doctor or somewhere else, so that's sort of having to just go with the flow. Dreams tell the soul's tale in persons, and the fragmentation into parts is held together by scenes woven into stories which include as well landscape, animals, and so forth. They show the psyche as it actually is, personified, pathologized, and manifold. Nothing is literal, all is metaphor. We see that we are ultimately a composition of images. One, our person, the personification of their life in the soul. The dream is the mirror where they show themselves. It seemed to Jung that the ego has not been produced by nature to follow its own arbitrary impulses to an unlimited extent, but to help to make real the reality of the total psyche. One sometimes feels that the unconscious is leading the way in accordance with a secret design. To bring the individuation process into reality, one must surrender consciously to the power of the unconscious. Instead of thinking in terms of what one should do or ought to do or what is generally or outwardly right, one must simply listen in order to learn what the inner totality of the self wants one to do. How far one develops depends on whether or not the ego is willing to listen to the messages of the self. Here we learn from Jung of the natural drive within the psyche to heal itself, to restore the balance and to provide material that is directed toward producing wholeness in the personality. What may appear to us as a momentary adjustment of our one-sidedness becomes rather in a long dream series, successive steps in a planned and orderly process of development. Jung said, "I have called this unconscious process spontaneously expressing itself in the symbolism of a long dream series, the individuation process." One further comment I make about this book on the feminine face of God, the one disappointment I have in it, Gene Bolan wrote the preface, and they did interview Marion Woodman at length. And Marion, who talks so eloquently about dreams, didn't mention dreams in the book. And I think they just sort of excerpted the particular experience, but I was kind of disappointed there wasn't something that came in there, because I do feel that God speaks through dreams. And they told dreams just spontaneously. But certainly dreams are important. Working with our dreams are basic to soul making. And I just will just make a few sentences about the fact that soul making is also myth making. That's probably obvious to any of you that have been really glued to all of the videos of Joseph Campbell. That my soul is that part of me that strives always to renew my awareness of what is universal, of the great motifs in life that are outside all personal interest and transcend all personal lives that are common to all. Psychology is ultimately mythology, the study of the stories of the soul. And the essence of psyche is certainly myth. Now, we could say there are two stages of soul making. The first involves going inward, finding your relationship to your own deepest ground, the ground of being, so that you become transformed. The second stage is bringing that realization back into the world. So at this point, I'll just note, in summary, the importance of the human connection for soul making. There is a statement in Zen, "This earth, that is the way." The way to enlightenment to soul is not through the clouds, not by denying this earth. It is found within this mortal life, within the simplicity of our mundane tasks and our relationships with ordinary people. There are words of a Native American teacher who said, "We need to bring our dreams and visions down to earth and put them into our lives. In my country, we can't just stagger around in our visions. The rattlesnake teaches us that. We need to be awake and to pay attention to where we place our feet." In Jung's essay on transference, he stresses the importance of the human connection for soul making, saying the conscious achievement of inner unity clings to human relationships as to an indispensable condition, for without the conscious acknowledgement and acceptance of our fellowship with those around us, there can be no synthesis of personality. The inner consolidation of the individual emphatically includes our fellow man. I'll skip some of this and maybe just sum up with the fact that through our souls we become immanent within one another, so that the I-thou relationship is a necessity. It is soul which converts the it into a thou. That is why Jung says that the cure of souls can only be carried on in the stillness of a colloquy. Soul must work on soul, and many doors be unlocked that bar the way to the innermost sanctuary. He says further that the logos in the form of a word or the Sunday sermon reaches the heart but seldom penetrates to the heart, much less to the soul. Does mere physical proximity or mutual exchange necessarily constitute a meeting of souls. In Knowing Woman, some of you probably know that book by Castillejo, she says that frequently husbands and wives have the closest physical intimacy for years and yet have no real meeting. Each is wrapped away in an isolation of his own. For there to be a meeting, it seems as though a third, a something else, is always present. You may call it love or the Holy Spirit. Jungians would call it the presence of the self. If this other is present, there cannot have failed to be a meeting. Duration has nothing to do with it, nor have common interests. To me, it is one's task, one's greatest task, not to learn to love, but to learn how to create the conditions in which love can alight upon us and remain with us. Now, one of the things that let me just mention it briefly. I'll skip some of it and make a reference to you.
Women writers today are pointing our attention to the fact that historical patriarchal models of the spiritual have not been nice to women. Consciously or unconsciously, the constructs that begin with spirit as the highest and descend to matter as the lowest have traditionally relegated women and nature to the bottom of the scale. Based on a cosmology that lies at the root of Western civilization in which the divine has been located outside the material universe, has had dominion over it, and is fundamentally transcendent to it, this hierarchical ordering is one that almost all of us carry in our minds, if not our hearts. Philosopher and theologian Elizabeth Dodson Gray says the goal of this hierarchical perspective is to get away from the ordinary, the natural, the unsacred, away from women, fleshy bodies, decaying nature, and away from all that is rooted in mortality and dying. Up, up, and away is the cry of this religious consciousness as it seeks to ascend to the elevated realm of pure spirit and utter transcendence where nothing gets soiled or rots or dies. Women are coming to know that the distinction between spirit and matter begins to blur as she honors the sacredness of her feminine nature and the intimate connection with Mother Earth. When we are able to reclaim the parts of ourselves that have been disowned, reviled, or feared, we may discover that we meet the divine more fully. Soul-making, as we have been discussing it, seems to be a significant correction to this problem. Images of souls seem to carry feminine connotations. Now, in this one, what I really will do is just to refer you to Hillman's work on revisioning psychology. I think it's page 68, because he makes a big point to contrast soul and spirit, and pretty much gets into the images of spirit as being blazing with light and fire, wind, sperm, fast, and so forth, in contrast to soul, which he says, what happens to soul when its phenomena are viewed from the perspective of spirit? Then it seems the soul must be disciplined, its desires harnessed, imagination emptied, dreams forgotten, involvements dried. The cooking vessel of the soul takes in everything, and everything becomes soul. Soul says, yes, this too has its place, may find its archetypal significance, and belongs to myth. Another topic, and it could be just a whole talk in itself, has to do with projecting the soul. Because of its elusiveness, we often experience and recognize the soul mainly through projection. What I would refer you to read on this is my favorite little book, is Robert Johnson's book, We. And in it, it's a beautiful little book on the soul. And it's Robert Johnson's book, We. It's a beautiful little book on the soul and the projection of the soul. And he has a commentary on the myth of Tristan and Isolde or Isolde. And also a lovely little commentary on the Sioux Indian myth of the white bison spirit woman. And there are a number of things you could read on the subject, but I think that would be the one that I would recommend. I think that, you know, basically, I mean, there's a whole topic about projecting the man projecting his soul or his anima on woman and her carrying it for him. And anyway, we could go into that a great deal. I think we could just simply say that we can project our souls on our partners, on sexuality, as well as our children, on our jobs, on money, et cetera. I don't think we have to limit it just to the anima. We can project it on money. We can project it on our work. And that somehow, you know, part of the aim is to become aware of this projection and begin as we can to simply recognize it. In conclusion, and this gets into probably Jung's final thoughts on the whole idea of anima mundi, soul in the world, and the unus mundus, the Jung's big words that he uses. But he said that the alchemist knew that at the creation, at least a little bit of a divinity, the anima mundi, entered into material things and was caught there. The only certain thing is that for the alchemist, matter also had a divine aspect. And Jung talks about the God image imprinted on the world and the oneness and essence of the physical world. The idea of the unus mundus is found on the assumption that the multiplicity of the empirical world rests on an underlying unity. Everything divided and different belongs to one and the same world. Causal connections exist between the psyche and body, which point to their underlying unitary nature. But this much we know beyond all doubt, that empirical reality has a transcendental background. The common background of microphysics and depth psychology is as much physical as psychic, and therefore neither, but rather a third thing, a neutral nature, which can be grasped in hints, since in essence it is transcendental. I mean, here we get into the whole work of people like Rupert Sheldrake and so forth, and certainly the whole dialogue today going on between depth psychology and physics and so forth, and finding the commonality between what we're talking about. And I think just in conclusion, I would like to quote from Hillman's colleague in Dallas, Robert Sardello. And I can't tell you the Hillman quotes it, so I don't know where, I don't know Sardello's particular work. But he says, the individual presented himself in the therapy room of the 19th century, and during the 20th century, the patient suffering the breakdown is the world itself. The new symptoms are fragmentation, specialization, expertise, depression, inflation, loss of energy, jargonese, and violence. Our buildings are anorexic. Our business is paranoid, our technology manic. The world, because of its breakdown, is entering a new moment of consciousness. By drawing attention to itself by means of its symptoms, it is becoming aware of itself as a psychic reality. My practice tells me that I can no longer distinguish clearly between neurosis of self and neurosis of world, psychopathology of the self and psychopathology of the world. Not only my pathology is projected onto the world is inundating me with its unalleviated suffering. Sometime, it's just something I'd like to work on. I could do a whole phenomenon with my interest in music as sound as a manifestation of the soul, and there we get into the whole vibratory. I'll become a new age person with this one. The whole phenomenon of vibrational work. But in conclusion, it is simply a therefore. Study, meditate, sweat, work, cook. The alchemist spoke of patience as the first quality of soul and considered soul-making the longest journey, a via longissima. The authors of The Feminine Face of God refer to the need for tools to cultivate the sacred garden. Until this point, we've had no need for tools because we are eating spiritual convenience foods, the products of someone else's cultivation. But now we are ready for a spade, a hoe, a rake, some compost, and perhaps a knowing friend to help us. So at this point begins the work, our own dreams, our own active imagination, our own meditation, all those ways that we have of contacting psyche that are particularly suited to us, whether it be through dreams, whether it be through movement, whether it be through art, whether it be through active imagination. The important thing is that we each find our own way and befriend our own unconscious, giving it energy so that it then gives us our foundation. The final comment of Jung's, which I would like to end with, is Jung says, and let this be the statement for this little exercise tonight, I can hardly draw a veil over the fact that we psychotherapists ought really to be philosophers or philosophic doctors, or rather that we already are, though we are unwilling to admit it because of the glaring contrast between our work and what passes for philosophy in the universities. We could also call it religion, for in the vast confusion that reigns at the roots of life, there is no division between philosophy and religion. I'm sorry to not have a much longer period for questions. I'm here until they want to boot me out of here, but I would be very glad to. I caught several questions during the break, and whatever the rule is for clearing out, if you have questions, I would certainly be willing to take those for whoever might like to stay to do that.
Perhaps anyone who needs to leave, please feel free to leave, and we can stay a few more minutes talk individually with Pat.
Let me just, in your leaving, recommend this one book, Modern Man in Search of a Soul. There is one chapter in here, I don't think I've quoted anything in it, called The Basic Postulates of Analytical Psychology. The Basic Postulates of Analytical Psychology is also in the collected works. That one chapter is an absolutely beautiful elaboration of Jung about the soul, and the soul being the essence of analytical psychology.
Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.